This is KSQD Santa Cruz. From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. My first guest tonight is film director and producer Eric Nelson. His films include Grizzly Man, Apocalypse 45, Dinotasia, and his brand new film, Daytime Revolution, a feature documentary that revolves around a week in 1972 when John Lennon and Yoko Ono took over the Mike Douglas Show. Eric Nelson, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Delight to be here. Big fan of the show.
Thanks. I know all about Daytime Revolution, but set it up for us. Tell us, what is the context of this movie? What happened that this movie is about?
In one week, the week of February 14th, 1972, John and Yoko Lennon, in essence, hijacked the Mike Douglas Show, which at the time was the most popular daytime television show in America, reaching 40 million people across the country. And in the city of New York, a 60% of people watching television watched the Mike Douglas Show. And they were given carte blanche to present their case for the counterculture. And this film documents those five shows kind of in chronological order.
Fantastic. I mean, I remember when it happened. And the Mike Douglas Show was a staple of daytime TV. And he always had a guest host. But his guest host was usually, you know, Pat Boone or somebody.
Zsa Zsa Gabor. In fact, I'm working up another documentary on the week when Zsa Zsa Gabor hosted the Mike Douglas Show, but that's another thing.
Well, was that as amusing as the week that John and Yoko hosted? No.
It was probably more radical, but other than that.
Really? I think you're kidding me, Eric.
I am, in fact, kidding you.
So he normally would have Zsa Zsa Gabor or Charo or somebody of that nature.
Right. And Yoko Ono had done a Mike Douglas Show a few months previous, and she was really the architect of this. She saw the potential of the show, and she, in essence, produced it. She really personally selected most of the guests and brought John along for the ride. But John Lennon was completely committed to completely with the program and committed to everything. And what you see across the five shows in the film is John and Yoko getting more and more comfortable and the real star emerging, which was Mike Douglas, who could not have been more gracious, accommodating, a great medium between the radical left, as you will, and mainstream America. Mike just did a great job of translating all of the chaos.
Sometimes when our rock idols acknowledge the real world, it's shocking, like when Bob Dylan mentions Burger King in one of his songs, or Alicia Keys. And I think when I was a kid in 1972, and John Lennon was on the Mike Douglas Show, it was like, John Lennon knows there's a Mike Douglas Show?
Well, at that point, they were ensconced in their Greenwich Village apartment watching an awful lot of television. So they were marinating in American popular culture. And John Lennon was many things, but one of the facets of John that people forget was he was an entertainer. The Beatles were very at home in the early 60s, at least, on variety shows and corny BBC things. So John was not an emissary from another planet. And it's fun because he gets back to his roots in this particular film. And frankly, John looks the only other Beatles film, the only other John Lennon I've seen that captures that kind of the complete John Lennon as well as A Hard Day's Night. He really, John, in A Hard Day's Night, is the total package of John Lennon. And this film, Daytime Revolution, on the Douglas Show, you get the complete John Lennon, the musician, the acerbic, caustic John, and the great musical rock and roll John. And they're all here in one package.
And there's a number of wonderful guests. And you actually got interviews with some of those guests today.
Well, that was key to the film. You know, in this film, I'm not a documentary filmmaker. I'm in the transportation business. And the idea was to go back into 1972 and connect 1972, that fraught election year of 1972, with our fraught election year of 2024. And the people who were on the set in 1972 All the ones we could find, we brought forward and interviewed them now. So they provide commentary and illuminate what you're seeing. So we did not reach outside of anyone who was not on that set. I did not want to make a film about this thing. I wanted this film to be that's the thing.
And you know, there was, you had at least, I mean, the show was 90 minutes and it was on every day. So you had hours of footage.
Seven and a half hours that we pretty much brought down to maybe 65 minutes. And that winnowing process took 18 months of editing. It was extraordinarily difficult, both creatively to figure out what to keep and what to lose, but also technically to figure out how to cut this down so it flowed smoothly. And the good news is, having seen it now three times in theaters, you really don't notice where the cuts are.
When it plays on the big screen, is it actually on film or is it a digital projection?
I don't know if anything, almost nothing plays on film anymore. If there's a few repertory houses that actually do film. But no, it's all digital now. It was filmed. It's about films, shows that were preserved on 2-inch videotapes. And we obviously shot the interviews digitally. So no, it's a complete product of TV start to finish.
Have you ever directed a film that was made on film?
I haven't directed. I've produced at least one. I think Grizzly Man was, Werner shot that on film. I don't think the other ones, I think Encounters, he switched to video over his dead body, and then Cave of Forgotten Dreams we did. No, I don't think I've ever worked in film in my 21st century directing career. I directed rock videos in the early 80s that were shot on film, but that's a whole different discussion.
Now you just did a little name dropping there with Grizzly Man. Tell us a little bit about Grizzly Man. Because
not name dropping, I just answered the question.
But, yes, but we don't know the story.
Yes,
we don't know the
produced,
people involved.
I did four film. I produced four films with Werner Herzog. The first one was Grizzly Man back in 2005. I think it came out. And then we did together the Oscar-nominated Encounters at the End of the World, and then the 3D film Cave of Forgotten Dreams, and then the finale was Into the Abyss, which is the last film we did, plus a TV series spinoff of that called On Death Row. And Werner, in turn, was the executive producer of my film Gray State and the narrator of my crazed animated dinosaur classic Dinotasia. So Werner and I are still pals. And in fact, we're bringing back Cave of Forgotten Dreams, completely reconverted and remastered and restored from the raw footage sometime next year to theaters.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
It will be.
That's wonderful. But let's talk a little bit more about your John Lennon experience. Did you remember this show being on when you were watching?
Vaguely. I would have been 16 when they were on. I wasn't watching TV, you know, daytime television directed at Housewives. I think I was in New Jersey at the time. So my instincts were at 4:30, I would be probably watching Officer Joe and the Three Stooges or the Little Rascals or Warner Brothers cartoons. I might point out things that I still watch to this very day religiously. So unfortunately, my tastes in media have not evolved.
Not evolved. You still watch.
Not evolved
same.
In the last 52 years.
What about Sea Hunt and Highway Patrol?
Well, that was earlier. The Sea Hunt would have been the mid-60s. I mean, Lloyd Bridges,
yeah.
Flipper, and don't get me started on early 60s television. But by 72, well, that's important, though, when you realize the media landscape. 1972, there were three networks, and there were syndicated things in the afternoon. So your menu of options was very, very limited. And that's one of the things that there was a monochromatic media culture in America. And we frame each show is in chronological order. We frame it with archive footage of what was on the news that particular night. And when we came to, I wanted to do that, but I thought, well, CBS, NBC, ABC, they must have recorded their newscasts. Nope. There were no recordings of their newscasts. And we floundered around until an archivist suggested going to the place where one person in 1972 was recording every single nightly newscast. And that was Richard Nixon. And all of those newscasts are in the Richard Nixon Library. So they had everything. So we were able to pull the nightly newscast. So Richard Nixon is the unindicted co-conspirator behind Daytime Revolution.
But Eric Nelson, aren't you on Richard Nixon's enemies list?
I've been doing my best to be on Richard Nixon's enemies list. In fact, these five shows were what got Richard Nixon all fired up to deport John Lennon, which was the subject of a film I was the producer, executive producer of, called The U.S. versus John Lennon about 15 years ago.
Yeah, that
which
was a great film.
One of the inciting incidents that had got reacquainted me with this material.
That film had a nice soundtrack album. Has anybody thought of doing a soundtrack album for your new film?
There's not enough music to go around. We've restored the music in the film. In fact, Sean Lennon, Yoko and Sean's music restoration team did the audio restoration. And on the home video, which is coming out in late November, we're presenting the uncut performances of Memphis, Tennessee, It's So Hard, both of which are in the movie, and one song that's not in the movie, which is Luck of the Irish, which they did in the last show, show 5 on February 18th. So, and the music was marginal. There's a great version of Imagine in the film. And I'm not sure the world needs yet another version of Imagine.
But of course we do.
We present the uncut performance of Imagine in the film.
Now, where was Mike Douglas politically? Did you find out anything about him?
I don't think he had a – he was very unmoored. I do know that his one of his producers, in fact, his producer in 1967 was a guy by the name of Roger Ailes. And Roger Ailes left the Mike Douglas Show in 67 to get Nixon elected in 1968 by taking over his TV. And Roger Ailes was in the Nixon White House when the Douglas Show's hit. And Ralph Nader in my film remembers Ailes watching very closely and stroking his chin and conceiving of the idea of Fox News as he saw what John and Yoko were doing. I think that might be slightly apocryphal, but Ralph Nader is pretty much calls it as he sees it. And if he says he saw it, print the legend.
Well, the review of your film in the New York Times mentioned how young and handsome Ralph Nader was in your movie.
Yeah, he looked great then, and he looks great now. He was the wise oracle in my film, and I was so delighted. If Nader hadn't agreed to do the interview, I'm not sure I could have completed the film. That was a huge get for us, and it was on tenterhooks for quite some time. And he was and remains very health conscious and concerned about getting COVID. So he, I think, lives in Florida. And no, excuse me, it was in Washington, and I directed by remote control from here in Santa Cruz. But he wasn't even in the same room with the crew. He was in a different room with a camera with a long lens. So everything had to be done at long distance.
But he does participate in this movie, and that's fantastic.
He's great, and he's very prescient. And part of this, as I said earlier, I'm in the transportation business. What Ralph talks about back in 1972 about empowering youth to vote and the importance of voting is something that is still insanely relevant today.
The music in the film also includes Mike Douglas performing. He was quite a singer.
Oh, well, and I think maybe the best song in the entire film, who needs John Lennon and Chuck Berry duets, is Mike Douglas's scintillating rendition of that well-known John Lennon classic, Michelle, which opens up the film.
Well, John did have some part in Michelle, I understand.
Yeah, John says, he gently corrects Mike and says, I wrote the middle eight. And that's the first thing they talk about when John comes out for the first show. But John, rather than rolling his eyes, in fact, he immediately says right afterwards, that often happens. People always play Yesterday when I come out. And I think you know Frank Sinatra's great version of Something, that other great Lennon-McCartney song.
Yeah, I want to dedicate this to Mr. Lennon and Mr. McCartney.
Yep.
The fact that it's written by George Harrison had not permeated his.
It's Frank's world. We just live in it.
Well, Eric Nelson, I'm excited that this movie is out, and I've seen it, and I love it, but I want to see it again, and I want to own the Blu-ray. I hope it's coming.
Blu-ray's coming, and honestly, Gary, this film is that you are the target demo. You may be the only target demo for this film. You're like the only person out there who will actually buy the Blu-ray. But
I hope I don't have to buy it. You're not sending me one? What the hell?
Well, we already got the interview done, so I don't have to bribe you off here. But we'll think about it.
Well, Eric, I hope you'll come back and talk to us again about your next film. And congratulations on Daytime Revolution, the story of John and Yoko on the Mike Douglas Show, and the director, my guest.
It's great, Eric Nelson. To join you.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. I was very sad to learn of the passing last August of Charles Cross. He was a fine author and a chronicler of rock and roll history and a guest on From the Bookshelf several times. Here's a tribute to Charles Cross from Bruce Springsteen.
I want to do this song to somebody tonight. Passed away last week. A great journalist and writer named Charles Cross. Charles was the founder of Backstreets Magazine, and his great writing and his influence and his help in communicating between our band and our fans will be sorely missed. This is for Charles Cross.
Infested summer, me and Terry became friends, trying in vain to breathe the fire we were forming. Catch your rides to the outskirts, tying faith between our teeth, sleeping in that old abandoned beach house, getting wasted in the heat. So hard to bear with your feet. Running for our lives at night out on those back streets. Slow dancing in the dark. On the beach at Stockton's Way. We're desperate lovers hard. We sat with the last of the Duke Street drugs. Huddled around cars. Wait for the bells to ring. When the key part of the night, they set us loose from everything. Tonight, riding on the back streets. Riding on the back streets. We swore we'd live forever. On the back streets, we take it together.
That was Bruce Springsteen paying tribute to Charles R. Cross, a very fine author. And tonight, we listen back to an interview that I did with Charles Cross, recorded in 2010.
The Jimi Hendrix Experience CDs have just been reissued, remastered. I wonder if you've listened to them, if you have any thoughts on the remastering.
Yeah, I have listened to them. They sound great. And, you know, as a classic rock guy, I'm encouraged by their performance on the chart. You know, it's a local music store here in Seattle called Easy Street, and I was just talking to the owner the other day, and he basically told me that he thought that it would be their biggest selling CD of the year, which, you know, when Jimi Hendrix, who's been gone for a long time, is at the top of at least a local music chart, that is something to get excited about. So I'm glad to see so many people be interested in it. As a, you know, freak collector, I did have most of this material, but I certainly didn't have it in this quality, and it's nice to hear it done so well.
Do you think there's a big sonic improvement?
On most tracks, I do think there is a big sonic improvement. You know, that said, you know, Hendrix's, you know, material in general was recorded very well at the time. I mean, his CDs in the 60s sounded better than most people's. But, you know, this is a great release, and it's so exciting to see people, you know, happy at the idea that there's new Hendrix out there. So,
well, the Led Zeppelin book, and it's called Led Zeppelin, Shadows Taller Than Our Souls, the albums, concerts, memorabilia, and biography of the gods of rock. It's a sort of a lovely coffee table scrapbook that includes lots of beautiful photographs and also lots of little things that you can take out and examine, replicas of tickets and stickers and posters and press releases and such, just the kind of thing that we love. And we've seen this kind of book before. There's one devoted to John Lennon, and there's one for Bob Dylan, and there's a Frank Sinatra book. Now, the subtitle of your book calls Led Zeppelin the gods, but do you think that Led Zeppelin have the quality, power, and influence and reach of Sinatra, Lennon, Dylan?
I do. You know, I mean, certainly when we're looking at the, you know, pantheon of the greatest musicians of all time, in my list, I have the Beatles, Dylan, you know, and Elvis is the, you know, kind of holy trinity of rock and roll, but... You know, that said, Led Zeppelin are certainly in the top 10, and when it came to the 70s and when it came to people who were doing specifically hard rock, there was, in my opinion, no one better than Led Zeppelin. You know, what they did at the time was so ahead of its time that when we go back and listen to that first record now, it's just shocking to think that it was recorded so many years ago, and yet it still sounds very thoroughly modern. So I think that, you know, Zeppelin, I wouldn't argue they were the greatest songwriters of all time. They certainly don't rank up there with many of the greats in that front. But as musicians and as performers and as creators of albums, those were the arenas that Led Zeppelin truly ruled in.
Their song structure was very unique, would you say?
It was. I mean, I think the underrated member of Led Zeppelin is Jimmy Page. He's not underrated as a guitar player. I mean, people certainly have for years been aware of what an incredible guitar player he was. But I think as a producer and as an arranger, he's been vastly underrated. You know, those albums, every single lick was elaborately produced by Jimmy Page. And the reason they hold up is because he was such a master at production. It's almost... you know, remarkable that after Led Zeppelin, Page did so little as a producer. I think he would have had a very large career as a producer if he would have continued in some form.
Well, actually, that's one of the, not just as a producer, but it's kind of surprising that he's done so little, period. I mean, in the last 10 or 15 years, he's done almost nothing. And his pal, Robert Plant, you know, just won Grammy, the Record of the Year, a year ago, and he's out there touring and playing, and except for the Led Zeppelin reunion, what is Jimmy Page doing?
Well, he certainly did a few things. He has toured, he has done a couple solo albums, but I do think that Page is almost like someone who's been lost without Led Zeppelin. Led Zeppelin was, you know, Jimmy Page's idea. He came up with, you know, virtually everything to do with the first few records. The other guys didn't really come on, you know, as songwriters and as, you know, contributors to the creation of the music other than being in the studio until, you know, really the second record. But, you know, so Page has been lost since Led Zeppelin broke up. I think he really had hoped that they would tour again, and Plant decided that that was not the direction he wanted to go. And so, you know, who knows what Page will do. You know, kind of, he did, of course, you know, appear in It Might Get Loud recently, and I thought he did a fantastic job in that.
It was a great movie,
you know,
yeah.
So someone actually approached me recently and said, you know, Jimmy Page ought to go on the road and just do a lecture tour because people would pay to see that because he's such a fascinating character and he has so much to say.
Well, one of the nice things that's inside Led Zeppelin Shadows Taller Than Our Souls is a lovely little CD with a 1977, I believe, interview with Jimmy Page. And it's great to hear him, you know, articulate his ideas in his charming voice.
Yeah, we included that in this release just simply because that particular interview I always had thought was the single best interview that Page ever did. And he did it, ironically, for a very kind of small magazine, a magazine called Trouser Press at the time, which was just essentially a step up from a fanzine. And, you know, he's so polite and informative and, you know, not defensive. And, you know, in many of the other interviews he did, he was defensive at times, and he felt that Led Zeppelin was not as well understood as he wanted them to be. And he got sick of being asked questions about, you know, Satanism and other things. So when I think he finally got together with this journalist, who is a guy that had worked in radio, named Dave Schultz, you know, it was a breath of fresh air, and Page responded by being very open. So we tracked that interview down, and we decided to include it because we really thought that it would be worth giving, you know, fans a chance to hear Jimmy really explain his own story.
If you talk to Jimmy, tell him he's welcome on From the Bookshelf anytime.
Yeah.
We're talking with Charles R. Cross, and his new book is a book about Led Zeppelin called Shadows Taller Than Our Souls. Yeah, so as an author writing about Zeppelin, is it daunting to face the fanatical fanship of the band? I mean, I saw some of the reviews on Amazon. You know, there's a fan that says, he got it all wrong. He said it was on a Tuesday, but it's clearly a Wednesday. You know, he said Jimmy Page's pants were purple and they're obviously magenta.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there is that fanatical fan base when it comes to Led Zeppelin. When I try to write my books, I try to appeal to both the fanatics, but also to a more general audience who doesn't care whether Jimmy wore the red pants on a Tuesday or a Wednesday. So if the fanatics actually like what you write, you know, or are perfectly happy with it, then you've probably missed the wider audience. So I try to, you know, be all things to all people in some degree. The fanatics, you know, are more interested in the particulars on each recording session and on each live concert. And in general, somebody who appreciates the albums cares more about what was this album about. And what I tried to do in this book was to place these records in time so a listener can read this book and go back and get a sense of where Led Zeppelin were when they made these records, as opposed to, you know, where we were when we listened to it. We think of Led Zeppelin immediately as being massively successful. But early on, when they recorded that first record, there was quite a bit of doubt whether they were even going to continue or actually be a group that would go, you know, for very long. It's important to understand that if you really want to understand what those records are about.
Well, you know, many fans of Led Zeppelin, and I guess the same could be said of the Beatles and Dylan, who come to the music now, you know, the whole body of work exists, and so they just sort of absorb it all as one. Whereas the kind of the arc, what you're doing in your book is recreating that arc from Led Zeppelin 1 to the end. You know, how it played out in time. So let me ask you about that. I mean, I realize that your primary goal in the text is sort of to discuss the music, and even though we were just talking about the Hendrix remasters and how nice they sound, you actually say you prefer the vinyl on the Led Zeppelin records?
I do. Of course, you know, Page was just, you know, fanatical about every little aspect. So he mastered this stuff, of course, for vinyl, not for CD. So I think the vinyl sounds warmer at times, Led Zeppelin, because they're playing, you know, half their catalog is what you would, you know, call hard rock. Hard rock doesn't work as well in the CD format because at times it can sound tinny. And, you know, I prefer the Zeppelin vinyl. Also, the Zeppelin vinyl, let's be honest, just is an incredible package. That's what we wanted to do with this book, was in many ways mirror the look of Led Zeppelin vinyl. You know, when Led Zeppelin vinyl came out, it, you know, it always had some elaborate packaging, whether it be the object of presence or, you know, the Led Zeppelin 3 with the Volveel crop circle. There always was something they were doing that was unique.
It was always an event.
Exactly. And I think you have to, you know, remember that at the time, because you forget when you listen to music on a CD or download, these were made to be albums. They were made to be listened to from start to finish, and they were made to be appreciated with the whole packaging.
And I guess they were made, although you say start to finish, but side one and then side two, right?
Yes, fanatical, you know, attention to detail and to track list. Page would spend weeks trying to figure out what the tracking was going to be on the album. And we lose a lot of sense of that if we listen to songs individually or buy one track from iTunes. You know, you really can't understand, you know, the song Black Dog unless you know where it fit on the album and sort of why it was put on that.
And wasn't Jimmy Page the first to carve little signals into the into the groove of the, if you picked up the record and held it in the right light, you could read what it said on it?
I don't know that he was the first person to ever do that, but he is one of the most infamous because many people felt that some of those carvings hinted at Page's satanic interests. And, you know, indeed, on a couple of the albums, there are quotes that are scratched into the run-on grooves that are quotes from Aleister Crowley. You know, it's remarkable now to look back and think about if we looked at the biggest music star of the day. So, I don't know, Dave Matthews, let's take for example, who's a fairly big star. If Dave Matthews suddenly went and bought the house that Charles Manson used to live in and started scratching Charles Manson slogans in the run-on groove of his vinyl or on his CD somewhere, and bought a bookstore that Charles Manson once owned just because he wanted to get off all Charles Manson's books, that's essentially what Jimmy Page did at the time. Imagine what a news story that would be today.
Yeah.
But in the 70s, no one paid any attention. Page went and bought Aleister Crowley's former mansion. Page went and bought a bookstore just because he wanted to get some of their rare occult books that Crowley had once owned. And he went so far as to go to auctions and buy Crowley's old smoking robes. I mean, he definitely was seriously into him. But at the time, nobody thought really much of it.
Well, do you think he was, you know, and I guess this is endlessly debated, but although it's clear that he was interested in Crowley, do you think he was seriously interested in demonic ideas? And did he practice witchcraft or whatever? Did the Led Zeppelin sell their souls to the devil?
I don't think they sold their souls to the devil, but they were devilish at times, and I do think Page had a serious fascination with the occult. Whether that equals Satanism, I think is a matter of contention. But he very much was interested in the occult. And what Page even said at the time, when the few times he was asked about it, is that he was interested in Crowley as kind of a more mystical person, as an oddball. And Crowley was very much an oddball, but he also was extremely interested in sexual magic and other things that, you know, in today's world would be, you know, front page headlines if we had somebody who was preaching that to a rock star. I think it is true that Page was into it, but it's also true that Page was into a lot of weird stuff, and it wasn't just Crowley that, you know, would have probably raised people's eyebrows if they walked in his house and looked at his bookshelf.
We're talking with Charles R. Cross, and his new book is a wonderful little coffee table scrapbook about Led Zeppelin called Shadows Taller Than Our Souls. Do you think there's a quality arc in Led Zeppelin's music? I mean, they started good, then they got great, and then maybe not so good in the end, or do you think it rose steadily, or what's your take on that?
I think they started incredible. I mean, I go back now and listen to Led Zeppelin 1, and that was the record that, I mean, I'd listened to all these albums hundreds, if not thousands of times, you know, prior to writing this book. But for the sake of the book, I went back and listened, you know, with renewed interest. And once again, what can I hear here that I've never heard before? And I think what I came away most impressed with were the first two records. Because from their very first album, Led Zeppelin, were simply incredible. Robert Plant had the voice then that he didn't exactly have towards the end of Zeppelin's career. Even by presence, he couldn't hit some of those high notes that he did on the first record. So I think they started great. I think they got even better. And I think by the end of their career, they were, as you sort of alluded to, trying to figure out where do they take it from there. You know, they'd been so big for so long that they got a little bloated, I think, and lost a little bit of their direction. You know, Presence, I think, is their weakest album by you know, a number of degrees. But I think by the final record, they were once again kind of righting the ship. And if we look back at Nebworth 1979 and, you know, Led Zeppelin were kind of responding to the punk movement that was happening in England at the time. And some of the tracks that they recorded for that album that didn't even make it to it, that ended up later on their kind of Odds and Sods album, I mean, really show a new direction that the band was going. And I think they, you know, it was hard for Zeppelin at the time because they were the single biggest commercial band of that era. And you had people, I quote one of the guys in The Clash in this book who had said infamously in 1979, I don't even have to listen to Led Zeppelin's music. All I have to do is look at their album cover and it makes me want to throw up.
Right.
So that was the kind of, you know, impact that Zeppelin had. They were uncool with the punks. But I think if time would have, you know, played itself out, Page was smart enough to realize that they had to recreate themselves.
So you think they would have gone in an interesting direction had they continued?
I do. I mean, you know, it's also true, though, and I think people forget this, is that the band was close to breaking up even before John Bonham died. That Bonham's death certainly is the final nail in the coffin, but that previous year, the final record, In Through the Outdoor, had been recorded essentially in two shifts. Page and Bonham would go in the studio at midnight and record their tracks and be gone by 6 in the morning. And Plant and Jones would come in and record the rest of the record, you know, during the daylight hours. And, you know, there was serious drug abuse and alcoholism going on the part of both Bonham and Page at the time. So, you know, this was a band that could have fallen apart 5 or 6 different ways. It's almost more surprising that they lasted as long as they did. But musically, if they would have been able to pull their personal issues together, I think this was a band that still had more to say. And, you know, that's the greatest tragedy about John Bonham's death. I mean, apart from the personal loss, but, you know, the idea of the band continuing without him was not something they were going to do. But we lost what, you know, how might Zeppelin had responded to punk rock if they would have had 3 or 4 more years to work that out.
Now, Jimmy Page's influence on the band lessened as time went on.
Absolutely. The first couple records almost could be described as Jimmy Page solo albums. Obviously, you've got Robert Plant's great voice. You've got John Bonham, you know, the greatest drummer rock has ever had. And, of course, John Paul Jones played a huge and, at times, I think, underrated role in the arranging of many of the songs. But all those people played a bigger role starting with the 3rd, 4th, and 5th records. The first couple records, Jimmy Page had written many of the songs before Zeppelin even formed, and Plant himself even said that it wasn't until Led Zeppelin III that he really found his own sea legs as a songwriter. So I think that Page, you know, began the album, you know, the first record and the second record, you know, with all these ideas, and eventually he kind of ran out of ideas and brought the other guys in more. So, you know, by the final record, you know, the final record, In Through the Outdoor, John Paul Jones has more impact on that record than any other single member. And he wrote a significant number of the songs and arranged the majority of them. And, you know, all you have to do is listen to it to hear how the keyboards dominated a band that at one point was, of course, dominated primarily by the electric guitar.
Now, well, you might think that the, you know, the living members of Led Zeppelin would be very pleased with this book. I mean, it doesn't talk about any of the things that they hate to have talked about, and it talks about all the things that they love to talk about. Have you gotten any reaction from Page or Plant or Jones?
I haven't personally directly. Someone told me that they had leafed through it with Page, and that he had found many of the items interesting. And you're right. You know, this is not a book about their wild offstage life. I certainly talk about that a bit because I think you have to understand that to understand the music. But I don't make that the main part of the story. You know, this is a book that, you know, really focuses on the albums, and that was my focus. There's so much that's been said about their offstage life. There's been at least a dozen books written that focus almost exclusively on what they did when they weren't making music. And Page and Plant have been adamant about saying that those stories are vastly exaggerated, that many times what's attributed to Led Zeppelin did something wild, it was actually Led Zeppelin's road crew, or more specifically, one of their road managers, who did something wild in the name of Led Zeppelin. You know, one example, just to go into it, I'll be discreet here, is, you know, the infamous Mud Shark episode
happened here
in Seattle at the Edgewater Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the story, the rumor is that Led Zeppelin, quote-unquote, defiled a groupie with a mud shark. And, you know, what actually happened, and there is some video of it, is, you know, John Bonham and Richard Cole, who was Led Zeppelin's road manager at the time, had a young lady in a bathtub, and they caught a red snapper out the window, and she had red hair, and they shot some pictures of her and some footage of her pleasuring herself with part of the fish. But the idea of Led Zeppelin sort of gang raping this woman with the mud shark, you know, is one of the great rock myths, and there's really very little truth to that. Jimmy Page or Robert Plant weren't even in the room when this was happening. John Paul Jones probably wasn't even in the hotel because he very rarely was involved in any shenanigans. 99% of the wild stories about Led Zeppelin, if they actually entailed a band member, entailed only John Bonham, who was truly a madman, both when he was on stage and when he was off.
Well, now, although your book focuses on the albums, you do quote John Paul Jones as saying how song-oriented they were. I'm sure their most famous song is Stairway to Heaven. Would you choose that as their very best or something else?
I wouldn't put it in the top 25, and I'm not sure that there's a member of Led Zeppelin other than Jimmy Page who would list it up there either. The funny thing about Stairway to Heaven is I think it is, my opinion, I don't know that it's a fact, but I think Stairway to Heaven is the one singular reason that Led Zeppelin aren't touring this summer. You know, everyone hoped for a Led Zeppelin reunion. And after they played the 07 shows at the O2 Arena in England, which were, you know, incredible concerts and highly touted, everybody hoped that they would tour again. They did some rehearsals, they began to talk about what they would do, and I think it is that one song that made Robert Plant kind of pull the plug on the reunion. He hated that song, it seems, almost from the moment he wrote the lyrics, and he kind of feels it's the albatross around the neck of Led Zeppelin. And, you know, I somewhat disagree. I think Led Zeppelin could tour, and people would come away happy even if they didn't play Stairway to Heaven. But Robert Plant feels that they would have to, and Jimmy Page, of course, loves the song. And that's one of the reasons there's tension between Page and Plant is Stairway to Heaven.
Well, if you went to see Led Zeppelin, what would be the one song that you absolutely had to have?
Well, one of my absolute favorite Zeppelin songs is the song Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You from the first record. And I cite this song in the book as truly the song that kind of made Led Zeppelin what it was. It was an old folk song covered first, or at least covered in, most people first heard it when Joan Baez sang it and included it on one of her records. The writer is a woman named Ann Breton. And, you know, if you would think that the hardest rocking band of modern times would kind of be formed around a Joan Baez song, somebody would think that you were smoking too much of, you know, 70s drugs. But that's truly what formed the original relationship between Page and Plant. The scene, as I painted in the book, is that Page lived in this very odd boathouse on the Thames River in a town called Pangbourne. And he invited Robert Plant over. And Page brings him in and kind of says, I've got to go run an errand. Who knows what Page was doing? He was really very, very eccentric. He still is, but he collected tropical fish at the time. So maybe he had to go buy a new, you know, tetra or something down the street. So he left, and he left Plant in his house. And he came back, and Plant had pulled out the Joan Baez album. And Page said, "That's interesting you pulled that out. That's exactly what I want this new group to do." And Plant said, "I love Joan Baez. I love this song. I love that." And it was like that was the first musical spark between these two men. And, of course, they covered the song on the first record. And it's a great example of what Led Zeppelin could do, how they could take a slow folk song and turn it into an absolute rip-roaring sexual romp that displays Plant's best singing, I think, that he did on the first album, and displays Page as a master instrumentalist. I can hear it calling me back home.
Journalist, rock historian Charles R. Cross. He passed away at the age of 67 on August 9th, 2024. That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.